Let me just tell you the format for this evening. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how I came to Dharma in recovery, and then we'll sit for half an hour. We'll have a 5-minute bio break, and then come back for a Dharma talk, and there'll be time at the end for discussion or questions and answers. To say a little bit about my way seeking mind, I grew up in the East Bay in Pleasant Hill, California, and I took drugs before I ever drank, but once I did drink, I felt like I'd found my best friend. You know, when I first started drinking, it was a wonderful warm feeling from the top of my head to the tip of my toes. And one thing I liked about drinking as opposed to drugs is that when I drank, I knew what was going to happen. Of course, that changed later. But at the beginning, it was a warm, fuzzy feeling that I really liked. But, you know, alcoholism is a progressive disease. And I found myself in my early 20s living in Juneau, Alaska, where I hit my first alcoholic bottom. I had a great time at the Red Dog Saloon. I have a lot of friends who live in Juneau, and it was a wild time. But I found myself sitting in a cabin in the snow once winter came. You know, when I got there, it was the land of the midnight sun and beautiful warm weather in May. And then when the winter came, it paralleled the downward spiral of my drinking. And my drinking had become very unpredictable, and I found myself sitting in a cabin contemplating how I might end my life. But the thought of suicide sort of offended my sense of humor a little bit. I thought, you know what? Maybe if I stick around, I'll find another way to live. So I came back to San Francisco, and I just intuitively started a spiritual quest. I went to the Quakers, I went to the yogis, and finally I came to the San Francisco Zen Center when I was 25 years old, and I just stopped drinking. You know, I wanted to plunge into Buddhist practice and live this way of life. And in short order, I was living at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. This is the monastery that Zen Center has in the Los Padres Wilderness, east of Big Sur. And we say in Zen, I practiced as if to save my head from fire. I lived there for several years, and I loved monastic life. I loved the clarity of not drinking. And when I left the monastery, I had married my husband there, and we had a beautiful daughter. We came back to San Francisco, and alcohol started creeping back into my life. It wasn't the wild abandon of when I was younger. It was very painful, painful secret drinking. My marriage split up, and I was raising my daughter by myself. And I was part of the Zen Center community. You know, I thought I could just put on that black robe and chant in Japanese, and everything would be all right. But finally, I'd gone back to school to get my teaching credential, and I was sitting in a classroom at San Francisco State, and I had a moment of clarity. I was shaking and sick from drinking the night before, and I thought, I can't be worthy of teaching children, which is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and drink as well. And it wasn't good for my daughter either. She was 5 years old by this time. And I also recognized in that moment that I could think of many wonderful Buddhist teachers who could give the most glorious, inspiring Dharma talks, but who harmed or destroyed their communities because of their inability to confront their addictive behavior, sexual behavior, substance abuse. So I got up out of that classroom, and I went and made a phone call, and I entered the rooms of recovery, and I started to get better. My life grew, my practice grew. Wonderful Buddhist teacher Katagiri Roshi has passed on, but he said, "Let the flower of your life force bloom." And I realized that there was no way that I could let the flower of my life force bloom as long as I was distracted and ashamed and mired in the darkness of alcoholism. So I've been sober now since September 28th, 1985. I was head student at Green Gulch in 2000, and the first thing I wanted to do once I'd been given permission to teach was to share the Dharma with people in recovery and to make a place at Zen Center for people in recovery so that we could experience this wonderful support of both Buddhist practice and the very homegrown, kind of corny and helpful prescriptions of recovery. So I'm very, very happy to share recovery with you and to share practice with you this evening. One of the things that I wanted to do after I'd given a lot of talks about Buddhism and recovery was to write a book. So my book is The Zen Way of Recovery. Shambhala titled this The Zen Way of Recovery, An Illuminated Path Out of the Darkness of Addiction. And I believe Ileana is going to put the title and a link for you if you'd like to explore that book, because it's really the Buddhist teachings that have supported me in recovery, along with my personal experiences in recovery. And I also take advantage of other wonderful teachers that I've encountered during these many years of Buddhist practice and recovery. Central to our recovery and central to our Buddhist practice is to learn how to sit still. And it was the French philosopher Pascal who said, most of the problems in the world come from human beings' inability to just sit in a room and not do anything. And of course, a lot of the mischief in the world that is done by people who are who think they're right and go around explaining how right they are to other people. So being silent, being still is a wonderful practice, especially in this crazy world that is so speeded up and so confusing and so divisive these days. And I think each of us might feel a little bit helpless or overwhelmed given the current situation in the world. But one thing we can do is cultivate our recovery, hold out a hand to another suffering person, and learn how to sit still with our strong emotions so that we know we don't have to act on them, that we can be an agent of peace in the world. So let's sit now for half an hour. I invite you to assume your meditation position, whatever your posture, whatever that is. I know for some people lying down is best. If they have physical limitations that make it hard to sit up. But if you are able to sit up, it's very helpful for me to do a spinal twist, to just put one hand on one thigh. And this does wonders for softening and relaxing the big muscles in the back and the shoulders. And let's take a few deep breaths together. I'm going to ring the bell 3 times, and then I'm going to give a guided meditation for the beginning of our sitting time together. And then I'll just be quiet and we'll sit in silence for the rest of the time. And at about 8:05, we'll take a 5-minute break to attend to our bodies, get a drink of water, and come back for Dharma Talk. Bring your attention into your body and allow your attention to rest within the perimeter of your body, taking some deep breaths. Allow your breath to extend to the farthest reaches of your body. Allow your breath to just assume its natural flow. And with a relaxed and opened awareness, begin a gradual and very thorough scan of your body, beginning with the top of your head. Place your attention there, the very top of your head, and without looking for anything in particular, feel the sensations in your scalp. Allow your attention to travel all around the dimensions of your head, bringing your attention into your face, relaxing the forehead, the eyes, the mouth, allowing the tongue to rest easily against the front teeth. Bringing your awareness down through the back of your head, into your neck and your shoulders. Let your breathing rest there where your neck intersects with your shoulders. This is a place of very common place where we hold tension. Bring the attention down through the arms, the upper arms, the lower arms, and into your fingers. Feeling your fingers from the inside out. You might notice as you attend to the sensations in your hands, that they become a little bit warmer, maybe even a tingling sensation. Bringing the attention back to the upper back, allow it to flow down through the upper back, the spine, and the lower back, and enjoying the secure feeling of your body resting on the cushion or the chair where you sit. Enjoy the sensation of your breath as the chest rises and falls. See if you can feel the sensation of your heart beating. The life force of the lungs. The sensations in the belly. Bring attention into your thighs, feeling the inside of your body down through the knees, through the calves, down, down into the feet and the toes. Feel the aliveness of your body. Can you tell where your body leaves off and the rest of the world begins? Or can you feel that as a very soft boundary and feel your interconnection with all beings, especially with the trees all around us that give us their life-sustaining oxygen? As we continue to sit in silence, thoughts and feelings, regrets, images will come to mind. And just notice them when they float into mind like clouds in an endless sky. Watch them as they pass by. And return to your original pure mind. Returning again and again to the delicious, life-giving sensation of the breath. Welcome back. We'll take a 5-minute break and I'll see you again at 8 o'clock. Welcome back. Well, I'd like to share with you tonight a chapter from my book, The Zen Way of Recovery, on the importance of humor. I'd like to begin, though, by saying that I'm really having a lot of fun right now collecting Japanese wisdom stories for kids. And I'd like to share with you a story from Japan about a Zen master named Ikkyu. Well, Ikkyu was born in 1394 in Kyoto, and he was separated from his mother at a very young age and taken to a Buddhist monastery to be raised by the monks. And this was true of many of the monks growing up in Japanese monasteries, that they had been orphans who were then cared for by Japanese Buddhist monks. But well, Ikkyu is a wonderful character, a very mischievous little boy. And this is a story about Ikkyu, who grew up to be a Zen master and a flute player and a tea ceremony master and a very beloved character in Japanese life. One day, there was a knock on the door at the monastery where Ikkyu lived, and a woman from the village came in and said to Ikkyu's teacher, "I've brought you a box of mochi. I made these myself." And she handed the teacher this box of these wonderful Japanese sweets that are kind of chewy with a very sweet center. Well, the teacher accepted the gift from the woman, but he noticed that Ikkyu was staring at the box with a great deal of interest. And the teacher said to Ikkyu, "Ikkyu, I know you'd love to have some of this mochi, but you know, the thing is, this mochi is very special. And for adults, it's like medicine. But for children, it's poison. So don't eat it, because it's very, very dangerous for boys to eat this kind of mochi. Could be very dangerous for you." And then he went out in the back and started sweeping the Japanese garden in the back. Well, Ikkyu thought about this and he thought, poison for children and medicine for adults, that doesn't sound right. So he called these two other boys, these two little monks, to come. And he said, "The teacher told me that these mochi are poison for children and medicine for adults, but that sounds fishy to me. Let's eat them." So they sat down on the floor and they opened the box, and there were 12 mochi inside. And so each of them got 4 of them. They sat and they laughed and talked and ate the mochi. And when they were all done, one of the boys said to Ikkyu, "What are we going to do when the master comes back? He's going to wonder what happened to the mochi." And Ikkyu said, "Don't worry. Don't worry, I have a plan." And they went in the kitchen, and Ikkyu reached up on the shelf and he took down the master's favorite tea bowl. And he bowed deeply to the tea bowl, and then he smashed it on the floor, and it, you know, broke into a dozen pieces. The other boys were shocked, but they heard the teacher coming in. They heard him putting his shoes on the shoe rack by the sliding door. And Ikkyu said, "Quick, put water on your face and act like you're crying." And Ikkyu rubbed his eyes so they were red and splashed water on his face. So when the teacher came in the kitchen, these three little boys were all just crying as if their hearts would break. And he said, "Boys, boys, what's wrong?" And Ikkyu said, "Master, I'm so ashamed. I'm so ashamed. I was playing with your favorite tea bowl and it broke. And so to punish myself, I've eaten a poison mochi and now I must die." And the other little boys were saying, "Ikkyu, we'll miss you, we'll miss you." Well, the teacher got down on his knees and he took Ikkyu's hands and he said, "Ikkyu, I've been very selfish and very foolish. You're going to be fine. You're not poisoned." And from that time on, whenever a neighbor brought in food for the community, the teacher would share it with the three little boys that were growing up in the monastery. One of the things I love about the rooms of recovery is how much laughter there is there. And I used to do H&I at San Francisco General at a recovery center that closed, but I walked in there to do my H&I commitment, and there was a sign on the blackboard that said, "I don't remember having a spiritual experience, but something sure as hell must have happened." Each morning at the three temples associated with San Francisco Zen Center, Green Gulch Farm, and Tassajara Zen Center, we chant the names of our ancestors. The men and women practitioners of our lineage who stretch all the way back to Buddha's time, and Tendo Nyojo, who was born in 1163 and died in 1228, is a very important name in the Soto Zen lineage because he gave Dharma transmission to our great ancestor Dogen Zenji. Dogen was the Zen monk that brought Zen from China to Japan. And there's a custom among Zen masters to spontaneously dash off a poem when they're on the edge of death. And this was Tendo Nyojo's death poem. "I've given you my all, tossing it your way with a hearty laugh. I entrust it all to the spring wind, for there is nothing more that I need to do." I want to see all of your faces, so I'm switching it up. And if you could show me your face, I'd really appreciate it. I'm seeing a lot of names, not so many faces. "I've given you my all." This is what Tendo Nyojo says. "Despite the truth of impermanence, of the illusory nature of existence, of the suffering we all endure, and I'm sure Tendo Nyojo had his share, I've given you my all," with a hearty laugh when he's on the edge of death. And this tells me that this Zen master was confident that his life was complete, as if he was drawing a sumi circle in the air, tossing it your way with a hearty laugh. In recovery, I often hear it said, we are not a glum lot. And as I say, one of the very surprising things to me when I crawled into the rooms of recovery, beat up by alcohol, was the laughter, which comes from the joy. We feel that we've survived a potentially deadly disease and we've lived to tell the tale with our fellow survivors. Humor is very important in our Zen practice as well. And when I first came to practice when I was 25 and I started hearing some of these wonderful Zen stories, a lot of them are really quite amusing. And I'm sorry to say that I didn't meet Suzuki Roshi. He died before I came to Zen Center, but I've seen films of him, and he was only 4'11". But he was very lively, very playful, a very childlike kind of nature. And I didn't really understand the terrible tragedies that he'd encountered in his life till I read his biography, Crooked Cucumber. That was the nickname that his teacher gave him. That book is written by David Chadwick, and it's a fascinating biography of Suzuki Roshi. I didn't know all the tragedies that had occurred in his life. But the stories that I've heard about him from his students show both his incredible vigor as a teacher. He could be very strict, but also a wonderful buoyancy and sense of humor. How can we laugh when there's so much suffering in the world? And yet we have the filmed images of Suzuki Roshi playing with a yo-yo and laughing gleefully. And perhaps this is one of the paradoxes of Buddhist practice. A Zen master of the 20th century who's experienced great tragedy, you know, playing with a yo-yo. A Zen master of the 13th century tossing off his death poem with a hearty laugh. The Dalai Lama, you know, forced to flee his home in Tibet to go to India, and yet carry on his practice. And if you ever get a chance to see him and Bishop Desmond Tutu in dialogue with one another, so much affection and so much playful teasing and joyful humor between those two men. So my hope for you and for all of us is that our recovery and our practice are accompanied by laughter. And laughter erupts from empathy, from the recognition of our common plight, from seemingly disparate things coming together in surprising ways, and as a relief from the stresses and vagaries of life. You know, on my bookshelf, my books about Dogen are right next to Roz Chast's cartoon books. I love the work of Josh Kornbluth. He's a monologuist who's often done one-man shows here in the Bay Area. And he's been a artist in residence at the Memory and Aging Clinic at the University of California. And he's very interested in the phenomenon of empathy. And he's learned at this Memory and Aging Clinic that people that get prefrontal dementia, when they do MRIs on these people, what they find is the empathy center in the brain. Yes, there's a center in our brain where empathy is housed. In these people with prefrontal dementia, that empathy center has atrophied and is dark. So Josh had to come up with a project as the artist in residence, and he started asking the neurologists there, what can we do to deepen our empathy with one another, especially at a time when there are such huge divisions and disparities in our country? And he was told that if a person who's had a very deep prejudice against someone, say of another religion, if they have a transformative experience with an individual of that other faith or race, they begin to feel a spark of empathy within themselves. We've heard stories of former gang members or white nationalists who've been transformed by the power of love and have disavowed hatred and violence. And sometimes this is just because they've encountered someone of this race or religion that they were afraid of and have been able to see the humanity in that person. And the neurologist gave another example, and that's storytelling. When we transform one another by listening to each other's stories. When I hear your story, my brain is literally changed. The neurons in my brain include you, and they make a path for you in my brain. And as you speak, your image is literally in my eyes, and your voice is in my ears. When you hear my story, you change. So when we listen to one another with open hearts and minds, we're transformed. Of course, this makes me think of the rooms of recovery where we hear one another's stories. You know, somebody from a friend of mine who's not in recovery said, why do you still go to those meetings after all these years? And I said, I get goosebumps when somebody is telling me their story and they come to that fork in the road where for some mysterious reason, instead of going down that well-worn path of addiction, they turn in a different direction. And when I hear that, my own sobriety is renewed and restored, and my belief and my hope and my inspiration is restored. So this is an invitation for all of us to listen to one another's stories and help a little bit with this worldwide revolution of empathy that Josh Kornbluth would like to see. I love stories from every tradition, and here's one I heard early in my Zen practice that has stayed with me. Two monks were walking through the forest, heading back to their home monastery, and they came to a stream, and there was a lovely young woman standing there, not knowing what to do. She was holding her kimono up a little bit around her knees, but she couldn't figure out how to cross the stream. And so she saw these two monks, and she said, please, please, could you help me get across the stream? And the older monk, without much hesitation, kind of leaned over and let her ride his back, piggyback across the stream. And when the three of them got across to the other side, the elder monk put down the young woman. She went on her way, and the two monks continued to their monastery. And after about an hour, they could see the roof of the monastery in the distance. And the younger monk stopped in his tracks, and he said, I can't believe that you carried that woman across the stream, that you broke your vow. We're supposed to be fully conscious and fully focused on Buddhist teachings, not on the women of the world. And the other monk said, well, I put her down about an hour ago, but you've been carrying her all this way. And when I heard that story, you know, I thought, oh, there's humor in Zen Buddhism. It's not all sitting cross-legged facing the wall, you know. It seems we begin to lose our sense of humor as we enter our 20s. That's a little depressing. According to the behavioral scientist Jennifer Acker of Stanford University, a Gallup poll conducted in 166 countries found that the average four-year-old laughs about 300 times a day. I taught third grade for a long time. Kids laugh a lot. But it takes 2.5 years for a 40-year-old to accrue that much laughter. Yes, laughter has many benefits. Having a sense of humor, being able to laugh at ourselves and the vicissitudes of life can be a buffer against spiraling down into a pit of depression and despair about the state of the world. As the American Zen master Mel Brooks says, humor has been my delicious refuge from the world. I love that. Even the Queen of England has her rough days. I remember several years ago, part of her castle burned down and her grown children were misbehaving and being described, let's say, unbecomingly in the press. In her annual New Year's speech to the nation, she said, and this just shows the characteristic British understatement. She said, every year she gives a speech to the nation on the New Year's Day. And she said, it is not a year upon which I will look back with undiluted joy. Suzuki Roshi was a powerful presence. And in his lectures, he laughed a lot. And I have heard some recordings of that. I heard that at the beginning of a 7-day sesshin, he said to his students, the problems you are having now, you will have for the rest of your life. And he tilted his head back and burst into laughter. Dogen Zenji might have had a pretty good sense of humor too. He referred to life as one continuous mistake. Well, thinking about humor, here are some aspects of cultivating a sense of humor. You know, why it's important to do it and what we get out of it. And I'm sure you have your own things to add to this list, but the first one that I thought of is everything changes, so why not laugh? You know, one of the invitations to lighten up and have a sense of humor is that everything is constantly shifting and changing. Whatever we're upset about today may change completely tomorrow. I mentioned David Chadwick, who's the author of Suzuki Roshi's biography, a Zen priest at Zen Center for many years. And he asked Roshi, if you could sum up the truth of Buddhism in just one phrase, what would it be? And Suzuki Roshi said, without hesitation, everything changes. I'd have to add, though, except Jennifer Aniston, because I don't know if you've noticed, but she never changes. Now, sometimes things are so outrageously funny or so outrageously bad that all we can do is laugh. And even though when we're going through the darkest of times, we can find comfort in laughter with those we trust the most. And for Day of the Dead, I taught third grade for 35 years. I would ask my students if they could tell us a story about remember a pet who had died, because most of them had experienced that kind of impermanence. And my student, Chris, thought for a moment and she said, well, I'll tell you about the day all my pets died on the same day. So this is Chris's story. She said she went to a soccer game and she left her hamster roaming around her bedroom. And somehow when she came back and opened the door, she figured out that her hamster had climbed up onto the top bunk of her bunk bed and had had either thrown himself or fallen off that bunk into her goldfish bowl where he drowned, and all the goldfish flew out of the goldfish bowl and thrashed around on the floor till they died. Well, when Chris finished her story, there was a stunned silence, and then somebody laughed a little bit, and somebody else laughed a little bit. And I said, you know what? It's okay to laugh. Sometimes things are so bad, all we can do is laugh. I mean, there's a saying in humor, too soon. I think it was also funny because this had happened to Chris a while ago, but that was such a incredible story. If they'd been a little older, I might have shared Samuel Beckett's observation. Samuel Beckett said, "When you're up to your neck in shit, there's nothing for it but to sing." Another aspect is that humor conveys our affection for and our connection with one another. Sometimes you meet someone and you throw out a little line, a little bit of humor, and they laugh, they respond, and you immediately know that there's an affinity there. With old friends, we remember stories from the past that make us laugh. My daughter Nova, now a gifted preschool teacher in Oakland Unified School District, she and I have been through a lot together, and we thoroughly enjoy one another's company as adults. She cracks me up. I recently came across a Mother's Day card that she gave me a couple of years ago, and on the front it said, "I got born, I grew up, I left home, I got a job, I'm not in prison." And on the inside it said, "What more could a mother want?" Humor can transform an argument and help you and someone you love remember shared bonds. Sometimes we have a moment when we notice we have a choice. We can be righteously indignant, we can get all puffed up and angry, or we can find something in the situation to laugh at, or a shared memory that can melt all animosity. In my work with children, I could get irritable. Children can drive you nuts. But I usually, and sometimes I would be a little curt and then I'd have to apologize for it. But often I could stop and make a joke. So one of my students might poke me with a finger. I hate that. And to get my attention. And I might say, "That's pet peeve 1325." So that, instead of barking at them. And I would feel better, and they would feel better. And get the good thing was I didn't have to apologize afterwards. I treasure many funny moments I shared with my third graders. I was out in Point Reyes a while ago, and I saw a former student of mine who was then about 25 years old. Anna walked up to me and shyly said, "I don't know if you remember me, but I was in your class." I said, "Anna, not only do I remember you, I remember when you raised your hand in class and said, 'Laura, what happens after you die? I forget.'" Of course, another thing humor can do is point to a larger truth. I used to remind myself now and then not to be surprised when third graders act like third graders. And then I would remember maybe I shouldn't be surprised when people act like people. As my friend James says, people, they're not what they're cracked up to be. Humor is often based on making connections between seemingly unconnected things. Humor takes us by surprise. One day I was walking in the hallway behind a couple of my students, and I heard Talia say to Tess, "Would you rather be buried or cremated?" And Tess replied, "I don't know, surprise me." Self-deprecating humor also has its place. We can find humility when we don't take ourselves so seriously. This can help us cultivate what I think of as a kind of warm-hearted detachment. Through practice, we can catch ourselves being self-righteous, and then we can feel a little silly. I read about a woman who felt that humility is a spiritual practice, and she found herself looking around a room thinking, "I have more humility than anyone in this room." Now, she was in recovery, so she had to laugh out loud when she caught herself thinking that. And maybe part of humility is to have a sense of humor, even about our shortcomings. We can stop expecting ourselves to be perfect. We can transform that negative voice in our head that is chastising us for our mistakes into a loving friend who will always be there for us, even when we're not at our best. Laughter can come when we recognize our connection to others. And I think this is the source of a lot of laughter in recovery. We can laugh when we recognize ourselves in another person's story, when we see ourselves in another person's foibles. We might think, wow, I've done that crazy thing myself. Humor is subjective. Something I might find funny could leave you cold, or vice versa. Humor can connect us or offend us. Humor is not always in good taste, not always politically correct, but it may be necessary to let off some steam. Alice Roosevelt Longfellow is famous for having said, "If you can't think of anything nice to say, come over here and sit next to me." Humor relieves stress. Studies show that humor has impressive health benefits. Laughter releases endorphins and the bonding chemical oxytocin, and it reduces cortisol, the stress hormone. Shared laughter brings strangers, coworkers, intimate partners, and family members closer together, which also reduces individual stress. Humor gives us the freedom to be outrageous or even offensive. The day after President Barack Obama was elected, the headline in the humorous newspaper, The Onion, the headline was, "Black man gets worst job in America." I wish I'd saved that. That would probably be a collector's item now. We can appreciate the subversive power of humor in this country with our precious freedom of speech. I remember Chris Rock saying, "George Bush was so bad that he made it impossible for a white man to get elected after him." Little did we know, right? In the United States, comedians and cartoonists have the freedom to speak truth to power without getting arrested, at least so far. And another aspect of humor is that it isn't necessarily benign. In fact, it can be quite aggressive. A comedian who does well says they killed or destroyed. If they don't do well, they say they died or they bombed. I've listened to comics talk about their craft, and many of them were painfully shy as kids or developed a sense of humor to entertain a depressed parent or distract a bully on the playground when they were young. I heard Chris Rock say, "I can't drink. I'm too small to drink. I had to be funny, you know, or I would have gotten beaten up every day." And if he could disarm the people that wanted to beat him up, he was okay. I grew up in a household myself where there was a lot of teasing, and I learned to give as good as I could, as I got. One of the best compliments we could get at the dinner table was if someone teased you and you came back with a zinger, my father would say, "Good comeback." Now, sometimes I don't look forward to seeing someone because their default position is to automatically mock me. Just as soon as they see me, they say something mocking, you know. I don't know what that's about. The literal meaning of the word sarcasm is to rip the flesh. Sarcasm, to rip the flesh. And we can use humor at someone else's expense. I've certainly teased others or said something I wish that I could immediately reel back in, you know. I like the expression, "I would have bitten my tongue if my foot hadn't been in my mouth." I notice, though, that I don't tease people unless I like them, you know. I don't tease people I don't already feel comfortable with. Still, it's worth asking when teasing is genuine affection or when it is disguised hostility. Of course, we should practice the way with diligence, as if to save our head from fire. Of course, we should take our recovery seriously. It's a life and death matter. We all have lost people along the way to this disease. But I hope we can bring some silliness and generosity and humor to the path of practice and recovery. When my daughter was a teenager, she walked through the living room and I had a bunch of Pema Chodron books arrayed on the coffee table, you know, The Wisdom of No Escape, When Things Fall Apart, The Places That Scare You, No Time to Lose. And my teenage daughter looked at those books and said, "Geez, what a drama queen." And I was able to share that with Pema Chodron. Humor can help us stop taking ourselves and our opinions so seriously. And this is a form of detachment, not a cold, cynical detachment, not a refusal to engage with the world, but a warm-hearted detachment that comes from recognizing the truth of impermanence, from understanding that the difficulties we're experiencing, the dark time we may be going through, is just another part of the path and will pass away like everything else. In the words of Tendo Nyojo, "I've given you my all, tossing it your way with a hearty laugh. I entrust it all to the spring wind, for there is nothing more I need to do." I'd like to ask you now, before we start discussion or questions and answers, to sit quietly in your meditation posture for a few moments and come back to your breath. I think it's a helpful practice to think of humor in terms of right speech, one of the spokes on the wheel of the Noble Eightfold Path. So as you follow your breath, I'd like you to bring these questions to mind and just let's examine for a few minutes your relationship to humor. Do I use humor to mock and belittle? Do I use humor to keep people at a distance or to disguise my real feelings or who I really am? Do I use humor when I honestly don't even know how I really feel? Do I use humor to connect with others in an affectionate way? Can I use humor in a skillful way to diffuse a tense situation? Can I use humor to relieve stress? Do I use humor to build bonds of affection and identification, especially in the rooms of recovery? Am I able to laugh at myself? Is humor a reflection of joy and love and delight at this crazy reality we find ourselves in? Or is it used to shame and diminish others? How can I use humor in a wholesome way? Can I find humor and at the same time avoid doing harm? thank you for your kind attention. And it's time now for discussion or questions and answers. I hope that something I said might have sparked something in you that you'd like to share with the group. Or you may have questions about practice or recovery. So the floor is open. Ileana, thankfully, is here to call on you. So if you could come down to the raise hand feature at the bottom of your screen, I think that's the easiest way for Ileana to spot those of you who might want to contribute to the discussion. Ileana's pointing out that it should be under the reactions tab on your screen.